Hello, this is Terrence McNally. Earth Day 2024 is next Monday, April 22nd. Here's my 2011 conversation with Janine Benyus, who coined a term and invented a field called biomimicry. After 3.8 billion years of R&D on this planet, failures are fossils. What surrounds us in the natural world has succeeded and survived. So why not learn as much as we can from what works? Nature has already solved many of the problems we grapple with. Animals, plants, and microbes are the consummate engineers. They have found what works, what is appropriate, and most important, what lasts here on Earth. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum. After 3.8 billion years of R&D on this planet, failures are fossils. What surrounds us in the natural world is what has succeeded and survived. So why not learn as much as we can from what works? Today's guest, Janine Benyus, coined a term and invented a field called biomimicry, which basically means imitating nature. Nature, imaginative by necessity, has already solved many of the problems we're grappling with. Animals, plants, and microbes are the consummate engineers. They found what works, what is appropriate, and most important, what lasts here on Earth. Something I learned from Janine is that in order to make things, humans usually beat, heat, or treat. That is, we either use intense pressure, intense heat, or powerful solvents to produce the chemical and physical reactions in our manufacturing processes. And it's usually the pressure, the heat, and the chemicals that produce pollution. But nature seldom uses any of the three. What if we could produce ceramics the way an abalone does, cables the way a spider spins webs, or filter water the way so many creatures do? What started as a brainstorm over a dozen years ago has grown into a way of looking and working and designing that has enormous potential to save us from ourselves. I find this one of the most exciting developments in the world at this time. According to Janine, we're now learning how to grow food like a prairie, create color like a peacock, self-medicate like a chimp, compute like a cell, and run a business like a hickory forest. And she says, quote, "The more our world functions like the natural world, the more likely we are to endure on this home that is ours, but not ours alone." On Free Forum, we explore the work, the ideas of individuals I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Janine Benyus is a natural sciences writer, innovation consultant, and author of 6 books, including Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature. Since the book's 1997 release, Janine has evolved the practice of biomimicry consulting with sustainable business, academic, and government leaders. She's co-founded the Biomimicry Guild, the Biomimicry Institute, and the web portal asknature.org to further this work. And her next book will be called Nature's Code. Welcome to Free Forum, Janine Benyus.
Thanks for having me, Terrence.
I mean, I look back, I think the first time that we did this might have been around the year 2000, back in the very early days.
Yeah.
Maybe even earlier than that, because it was just after the book came out. I like listeners to get to know the people behind the work and the ideas. So I've asked you about your path before. So I'm going to ask you again about your path to the work that you're doing. But let me also ask you to include 2 other things. Mm-hmm. First, what might you be doing today if you hadn't been called by biomimicry? And have there been a moment or a couple of moments along the way that were really pivotal, where this path not taken, that path not taken, that has led you to where you are today?
Those are great questions, great questions. Well, you know, I would probably, if I hadn't written biomimicry, and more importantly, if the world hadn't responded the way it did, I would still be writing natural history books. You know, my life's work is to make the invisible visible in terms of how amazing the natural world is. And in these later years, it's been not just amazing, but how instructive it is. So I would be writing about the story of life, and what's all around us, and you know, trying to increase awe and admiration in the world. I think I still would be doing that. But what happened was that when the book came out in 97, after it was my sixth book, and it wasn't, you know, all my other books were natural history books, just describing organisms and plant and animal adaptations. And in this case, it was not just how incredible photosynthesis is, but it was talking about the people studying photosynthesis and leaves to make better solar cells. So it was bringing that emulation piece into it. That was biomimicry. And right after that, companies started to call, organizations started to call, even communities, and say, you know, we're designing new products, we're trying to revamp our chemistries, we're trying to organize ourselves in new ways in cities. Can you bring some biologists to the design table and help us think the way nature would do this? And how would nature solve this? How does nature cooperate? How does nature filter salt from water? We're making a desalination membrane. And they assumed I had a company of biologists who did this work, and I didn't. I was writing another book at the time. But what I realized was here was an opportunity to not, you know, I'm still writing natural history. But right now, when I describe how a kingfisher dives into water without a splash, there's, on the other end of that, is a train manufacturer trying to make a faster, a more efficient bullet train, you know, and by mimicking that beak. And so what happens is that they still become full of awe and admiration for the organism, but we also have a more sustainable world in the process. And so I feel amazingly fortunate that I've been able to take my love of natural history and move it to such good effect, I hope.
Yeah, I remember I looked at some of your earliest books, and they were a field guide to the plants and animals of this little section of Montana or something. And I'm sure that for you, the love of those moments was, you know, was what it was, but the impact, the ripples of what you created here.
Yeah, it's been incredible. And so when the universe basically says, you know, invites you to a seat to, you know, to hopefully illuminate a whole new field and help a whole new field emerge, that's what it's become. You know, biomimicry is this emerging discipline, really. And so we... you know, we've been asked basically to design the emergence of a discipline so that it doesn't go away, so that, you know, people can go to biomimicry degrees in university. And, you know, our goal is that every inventor, designer, engineer, architect, chemist, one of the first questions they would ask in any design or deliberation is, how would nature solve this? And in order to have that be successful, you have to train people to deliver the biology. You have to gather tools like AskNature.org. You have to train people to even think about asking the question. And so bringing these two, biology and the way the designers, the way, you know, the people who make our world together, it's actually quite a big project.
Well, I was going to say, one of the simple things is that academia, and I imagine even within companies and so on, there's such a separation and a silo of the designers are apart from this. And so when you talk about making an academic discipline of biomimicry, you're talking about something that is interdisciplinary by nature, as it were.
Yeah, it's definitely a team sport. But what's... you know, what's kind of appalling is that the people who make our world, who design everything that we, you know, live in and ride in and work with, all our implements and tools, our agricultural systems, the people who make policy, very often they don't have to take any biology.
Right.
So, so it really is, you know, getting them introduced to one biology class. This is what we're trying to do at universities. One biology class for the people who make our world, and it's biology taught functionally.
Mm.
And it actually comes before, so say you're a mechanical engineer, you would learn how nature pumps before you would ever pick up a mechanical engineering text. So you'd learn about hearts of whales and how this incredibly, you know, amazing pump at low, low energies per pump without a motor, you know, without fossil fuels, so that when you then went to do mechanical engineering, you'd think twice. So that's the, you know, that's one of the goals.
That sounds really exciting because there's such leverage at that early point in people's learning.
Yeah.
I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Janine Benyus, author of Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature, and founder of the Biomimicry Guild and the Biomimicry Institute. And you can learn more by going to biomimicry.net, and I'll spell it, M-I-M-I-C-R-Y, biomimicry.net. This is Free Forum, and you can visit me at terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website, to learn more about the show, guests, podcast transcripts, and so on. You can listen to podcasts there or at iTunes. You can sign up there or at iTunes to have the podcast delivered to you weekly. You can also sign up there or email me at T.E. McNally at Mac.com to sign up for my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about. What happens? I mentioned the Biomimicry Guild and the Biomimicry Institute. What happens at those two places?
Well, the Biomimicry Guild is our consulting firm. And what we do there is companies come to us with a challenge. How do I make genes more durable so that we don't have to throw them away as often? Or how do we make genes without using dye, without using indigo? Because, you know, textile dyes are one of the nastiest things that we have to clean up in wastewater. How does nature insulate without styrofoam? And so we go off and we do a library safari through the literature, which is great fun. But we do it through the lens of function. Say it's how does nature insulate. So we'll go through all taxa, all classes of animals, from bacteria all to plants. How do plants insulate? How do mammals insulate? And we'll look through thousands of papers, come up with the amazing mechanisms and strategies of insulation, and then put them into some sort of a taxonomy, some sort of a categorization scheme, and go back to the client and say, guess what? Not one of them does it with styrofoam. It's amazing.
Wait, it took all that research?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting when you go, even a client will come and say, well, you know, yellow dye is full of cadmium, and it's we want to get away from yellow, and give us a better formulation for yellow. And we'll say, okay, well, the real question is, how does nature signal, and how does nature create color? And sometimes nature creates the most brilliant colors without any dye at all.
Would they do it with it's the surface texture or something?
Yeah, it's the exactly. It's layers. Like, you know, when you see a morpho butterfly or a peacock or whatever, they're really brown, and there's layers, transparent layers often, and then light bounces through those layers to create that color to your eye. In fact, there's a Qualcomm has a new display that will be put into things. I don't know who's going to be buying them, but it would be an e-reader kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no backlighting because each of the pixels has layers that get, you know, farther apart or closer together to create different colors to your eye with the ambient light. Really low energy screen. It comes from, you know, butterfly research. Anyway, so that's what we do. We bring nature's ideas to the design table, and then, and not just the mechanical ideas. I mean, we also have a set of life's principles that we use. And this is what's really cool. We've sort of gone into a question our clients asked us, actually, is, well, you know, all of these little mechanisms are cool. The butterfly's cool. But is there anything that all organisms have in common, any design principles that we should be following as a carbon-based life form on the Earth, you know?
It does seem like the real question. Once you've done a couple of these searches, or you've hired you to do a couple of these searches, you go, wait a minute, there must be some overriding guidelines here.
Exactly.
There must be the missing manual.
Exactly. And what's interesting is that, yes, there are these design principles. You know, things like, you know, how are some ecosystems so resilient? What are the characteristics of them? Nature does chemistry in water. It doesn't do it in toxic solvents. That's completely different from what we do. Nature, as you were mentioning, you know, does heat, beat, and treat processes we do heat, beat, and we are nature, but our industrial processes right now are heat, beat, and treat. And nature, you know, makes a spider makes its silk in water. It body temperature. And so there are these amazing kind of aspirational goals for us. And we use those as, you know, to help create and to sort of hold ourselves to a higher standard, these life's principles. And so we try to stay with a client, you know, not just to make a gizmo. I mean, we only work on things that are really going to move sustainability ahead. And then we try to say, okay, well, now, how are you going to package it? How would nature package this? How would nature ship it? What business model would nature use? You know, we try to have a sort of an ecological look at it as well.
Okay, one of the things I want, I mean, before the hour's over, we're going to get to some more specific examples, like the bullet train and the Qualcomm screen based on the butterflies and so on. But I want to talk a little bit more about the sort of the big picture. So I've read that the practice of invention with biomimicry can proceed from biology to design or from design to biology.
You know,
what does that mean?
Well, you can we do workshops and bring people out into the Costa Rican jungles and Peruvian jungles. And in that case, you're walking through a forest and you're getting inspiration from biology. And then you say, my God, this is an amazing mechanism. Look at how this tendril works. And then you say, what problem could this solve and how could we make it into something by emulating it? Not using it, but emulating it. And then the other way around is you have a problem and then you break it down to function, you know, getting salt out of water. And you say to yourself, okay, what else in the natural world does this? So then you go to biology and you say, ah, you know, kidneys, how do they work? And nasal glands of seabirds, how do they work? And so we've tried to do that at the Biomimicry Institute. We've created AskNature.org, where you're able to go in either direction. You can just, you know, it's a collection of nature strategies organized by function. So you can browse the biology and say, wow, that's a cool strategy. I wonder what I could do there. Or you can type in a function into the search box. You know, how would nature distribute fluids and overcome, you know, the patterning of leaves and the mathematics behind the leaves and what's the best flow structure. So we're trying to move it beyond. At the Institute, Biomimicry Institute, we do academic education, K-12 to university, and then we try to create tools that are public domain, free, available to inventors anywhere.
Okay. I'm talking with Janine Benyus, the author of Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature, and the founder of the Biomimicry Guild and the Biomimicry Institute, and you can learn more at biomimicry.net. Now, you also, and you sort of have inferred it a little bit so far, but you've talked about three levels of biomimicry. The things that strike me as most obvious are the material things, such as I said, cables modeled after spider webs, but you can also model processes, how something is done, and even systems, such as how things are organized. You can organize those after nature. Can you talk a bit about processes, systems, and some examples?
Yeah, you know, the former, that's the blueprint. You know, that's the actual shape, and often very incredible sustainability things come from it. You know, streamlined shapes for reducing drag and lightweighting strategies. That's form. But then you always get to the point of saying, okay, I've designed a fabulous wind turbine based on humpback whale flipper tubercles. The question is, how are you going to manufacture it? And that's process. What energy source are you going to use? Life uses current sunlight. So the whole idea of photosynthesis is a process, mimicking that, mimicking life's chemistry. This is that self-assembly chemistry at low temperatures using abundant raw materials. That's a process. Another process is natural selection itself, which is mimicked in these optimization softwares that allow you to sort of have a natural selection process on a design until it gets better and better and better, like natural selection. That's also a process. At the ecosystem level, this is where we begin to say, okay, how does this product or process fit into a larger whole? And so, for instance, we'll we'll go to a company and we'll do a food web workshop in which we look at all the material, all the stuff that they buy to create their product, and then all the stuff that gets put up the smokestack or out into the dumpster. And we begin to say, is there a food web that could be created here? That's, with your suppliers or with other people who would buy your byproducts. That ecological thinking applied to industry is an ecosystem level.
Okay, and does that, when I thought about systems, I also wondered about taking it outside of manufacturing or outside of engineering and applying it to social communities or political entities. Has anyone come to you and been willing to be humble enough to ask about that?
Well, increasingly. This is what's really interesting. We kind of go in to a group of inventors, and they basically want us to start with product, but invariably, managers will come around and go, what are you doing in there?
Uh-huh.
Learning from nature. And then they'll say, you know what? How would nature teach us about how to organize ourselves? And in fact, the life's principles work really, really well for that. And so we might talk about cooperation strategies in the natural world. How and when and why does nature collaborate? And what are the conditions that foster collaboration in the natural world? Increasingly we're doing this organizational change work or organizational development work. The other big scale thing that we're doing, which is really, I think, really exciting and groundbreaking, we're hoping, and that is cities.
Okay.
Biomimicry applied to cities.
So tell me a little bit, has that just begun to happen and you're just sort of having your first conversations? I mean, that does sound exciting.
No, actually, we've worked on two cities so far, and with what I'm about to tell you. But all in all, we've brought life's principles to about 30 projects.
Mm-hmm.
The big ones are in India and China, and we work with a company called HOK. They're the largest architecture and engineering and planning firm in the world, and we're talking about cities of 2 million people, some of them, or developments of, 80,000 acres, and the question and retrofits of cities. What we do is we go in as biologists and we study the genius of place. We study the ecological dynamics of that place, figure out what are the important stories, whether it's cyclical flooding or hot and dry seasons or fire regimes. And this is something that really hasn't been brought to the table, the ecological story of the place. And in that story, you start to learn from the organisms how to best live there. How do you cache water in that place? How do you clean water in that place? The organisms have been doing this. And then the other thing is that instead of just nature as model, we're looking at nature as measure. And this is a cool thing. It's ecological performance standards, we call it. And what this is we say, if we weren't there in this city, say this city was a native ecosystem, and say it was like the wilderness next door, what would that ecological system, what services would it be providing? And we've got data about this in our scientific literature about, that it would clean this many gallons of water a year. It would absorb this much water in a monsoon. It would reduce this much erosion. It would foster this much biodiversity or build this much soil a year. And we then take those ecosystem service metrics and we say, city, this is what you have to meet.
Mm.
You have to meet or exceed the functioning or the services that would be provided by a system of this place. If you weren't here. And,
yeah.
And the thing is, it seems simple, but it's actually hugely aspirational, because what we're asking is, you can't just plant trees and hope to, I'll cool the city with trees and I'll get my carbon storage with trees. It's not that. It's bringing nature into the city, but it's also, how are the buildings contributing? How are they storing carbon? Are we creating buildings with cement that sequesters carbon? Can we be building soil around our landscaping? How are our streets and our sidewalks storing water beneath them? So it's really an interesting lever for moving design towards function, towards ecological function. The big goal is that you would fly over a wilderness area next to a city, and you'd look down and you'd see, you know, you'd think about all these wonderful services coming up from this generous system. And then you'd fly over the city, and it would be functionally the same.
Wow.
Yeah.
And now, you said it's a very, very big aspirational goal. Is the hope that done right, we can come close?
Yeah. We worked on this city in India, a development in India, and we gave them a 20-year timeline to do this. We started at a baseline, and what you need to do is you need to get the city managers involved and have them actually have it as one of their metrics. So city managers are always they're always measuring things like traffic flow or literacy rates or health rates, smoking rates. You know, they have things they measure all the time. So this gives them a set of things to measure. You know, that this much water is being cleaned by the city.
Let me jump in for one second, Janine. Yeah. That's the voice of Janine Benyus, author of Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature. You're talking now about nature services. That concept may be new to some people. People think of nature's resources, but not nature services. Tell just a little, set that up just a little bit.
Okay, yeah. You know, an ecosystem is an incredibly generous thing. When you think about the forest that's near you, it's producing, we always think of it as producing timber, you know, but it also produces goods, but it produces these services. And the services are things like cooling the air around it, cleaning water, storing rainwater, pollination, supporting biodiversity, building soil, scrubbing and cleaning air. This is a forest, or any ecosystem, actually provides those services. And what's interesting is they don't provide clean water just for themselves. I mean, it goes downstream.
Yep.
And so it's this idea that can a city be as generous as an ecosystem? You know, we've been, much of our sustainability now is towards zero. It's towards zero net impact, which is a good goal because right now we're in deficit. But this is, can we have a positive net effect? Can we actually improve where we live and the whole watershed that we live within and beyond?
Okay. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Janine Benyus, the author of Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature, founder of the Biomimicry Guild and the Biomimicry Institute. And you can learn more at biomimicry.net. And then I'm also going to give out the other website, which is the one which is asknature.org, which is where you can go and ask how nature does just about anything. And how has that grown? When I spoke to you 2 years ago, you were just setting it up. How is it going?
It's going well. We've got about 8,000 registered users. Our biggest user group is students who are in the design professions right now in college and 4 years about to make our world. And for their coursework and for their, there's a lot of people doing biomimetic design labs. They're using this heavily. It's very global. Almost every country in the world is using it. It's very interesting to us. We feel that we need to take it to the next level and make it even more usable by our design and innovation community. I was just meeting with Autodesk, who's our funder. And one of the things we're going to be doing is moving from just the concepts. Right now you go on Ask Nature and you find ideas. You find great ideas. You can read papers and meet scientists who are doing this work. But we want to move it from concept to content, meaning you can download something a 3D digital model, say, of a kingfisher's beak.
Wow.
That you can then put, if you're you know, the tools that the people who make our world use every day are tools that are 2D and 3D CAD and CAM programs or computer-aided design.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to be able to have people download a shape, say, and then be able to put it right into their inventor program is what the Autodesk version is. And say you're making a train, you'd be able to put that kingfisher beak on the front of a train and then start to play with it, get it larger and scale it, and actually test it in the computer, do computational fluid dynamics and finite element analysis. And what that does is it really helps make the bridge between cool idea in the natural world and I'm actually using nature's ideas and really learning from them and able to, you know, bring it to innovate to the level of an innovation.
That sounds excellent. And that's beginning to happen now.
Yeah, we just had the meeting with Autodesk, and we're going to try our first process. What they've got right now, which seems like science fiction, but it's true, you can take cameras, like your cell phone camera, and go to the California Academy of Sciences and find a kingfisher beak and take pictures of it all the way around, 380 pictures, click, 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 and then you send that up into the cloud, and then those pictures are stitched together to create a 3D mesh that a 3D model that you can actually work with in the tools. And this is a kind of a quantum leap for
yeah.
us. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking today with Janine Benyus about biomimicry. I remember one thing I read years ago in a Business Week article, and this was about goat tech. Where Nike created GoTech, the running shoes, and they were discontinued after just one season. And the design of the shoes faithfully mimicked the feet of mountain goats, and maybe human beings weren't that interested in having goat feet, however nimble it might make them. And the writer in Business Week wrote, "The company's failure may provide a valuable lesson about the challenge of biomimetic design, that it may be more profitable not to copy nature, but instead to translate ideas in a way that's appealing or even invisible to a human audience." And I thought at that point, having come out of the entertainment industry, that that's what one does when one adapts a novel or a play.
Mm.
In other words, you recreate it exactly, it's probably not going to be successful because you've changed medium.
Yeah.
But if you take what made the novel work as a novel, and you now say, now what are the elements in there that will work as a film in the different format, the different structure, the different experience, those are the successful adaptations. And that sounds like that goes back to what you were saying about nature's principles.
Huh, it's interesting. Yeah, it's a great thank you for that. I didn't know about that. It's a perfect analogy, though, because, yeah, we say we're abstracting a design principle, and really that's the big art and work of biomimicry, is to look at a whole lot of examples in the natural world and then say, what is this trying to teach me? What's the design principle? For instance, there's this beetle in the Namibian desert in Africa, and it pulls water out of fog. There's no groundwater, but it puts up its wing scales, and it literally combs water out of fog 10 times better than our fog-catching nets. So you've got to look at this critter and go, what are you doing? You know, and so it turns out it's these bumps on its back, and it has these water-loving tips and these water-shedding sides, and fog builds up on the tips, and the ball of water gets big enough, and then it rolls down these really waxy chutes and into the critter's mouth. Now, people who are making, say, building skins to comb water out of fog, or agricultural panels to comb water out of fog, are just taking the design principle, which is, water-loving next to waxy domains, patterns. So they're just making squares, a plastic sheet with squares that are water-loving and water-fearing. And that's enough. That's what it learned. So the abstracted design, you know, those panels don't look anything like a beetle.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's the same thing. And that's the art of it, really, is to say, what is the essence of this lesson? And that's what makes our work really so fun, is to try to... And when you go to Ask Nature, you'll see that the sentence that describes the design principle is that abstraction.
Uh-huh. In other words, what is it that's going on here, not specifically what is... You know what I'm saying.
What's the process that's going on? Idea.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a transferable idea, the big thing to pay attention to, if you will.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to ask you about the WIES Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering, which I came across. I just happened to be looking, you know, in this field, and it turns out, for people who don't know this, in January 2009, Harvard received the largest philanthropic gift in its history, $125 million, to create the WIES Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering. And as I read it, I said, this is biomimicry come to Harvard. By emulating nature's principles for self-organizing and self-regulating, this is WIES's own writing, WIES's researchers are developing innovative engineering solutions for healthcare, energy, architecture, robotics, manufacturing. We are now beginning to understand enough about how nature builds, controls, and manufactures so that entirely new engineering principles will be discovered. Talk a little, I assume that you guys are in conversation in some way. Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Don Ingber began that institute. Hanford WIES, the donor, actually requested that Don be the person to run it. And Don has been a biomimic for a long time, and it is really a kind of a breakthrough. Just the amount of funds devoted to this is just great. You have people on staff like Joanna Eisenberg, who studies Venus Sea Basket. It's this sponge that's in marine environments. And it has tiny, very thin little filaments of glass that are basically fiber optics. They are fiber optics. They bring light down into the base of the organism. And but the only thing that's different with those and ours is that you can tie theirs in a knot. They're flexible because they're not made. You know, they're not made in a big kiln, right? They're manufactured right in or near the organism's body. And so we're learning all kinds of tricks about manufacture, about light, about that's a very interesting group to watch. But there are centers like that popping up. There's one at ASU. There's a big biodesign center.
ASU, Arizona State, right?
Georgia Tech. Yeah, they're really happening all over the world.
Oh, that's so exciting. I mean, I must say, when I saw this, I said, okay, there's some one question I did want to ask you, which I was going to say in my own sentence. I was going to say we're getting closer to some sort of tipping point when the largest philanthropic gift to Harvard is for this. Answer that. How close are we to a tipping point? To where there's enough of a critical mass of people who know it, who see its benefits, who are investing in it, or perhaps the tipping point comes merely from we don't quite see it out in the manufacturing world, but we see it in the schools, that we say, the next generation has it. What's your sense of that?
It is coming on fast. I do think we're approaching a tipping point. I mean, I've been watching since 1990. I've been crawling scientific literature every day, and now our team does this, crawls the scientific literature, pulls out keywords, crawls the patent database, pulls out keywords, crawls the SEC filings. So we're seeing, so that we can see, when products are coming to market and when whole companies are being built. And when whole, there's a $1 billion manufacturing plant to make these Qualcomm display screens. So you're starting to see huge investment. I've talked to some VCs in California who have talked about having a biomimetic innovation fund, that's a VC fund focused just around bio-inspired, I feel like it's happening on all fronts, this emerging discipline. It is happening at university level, and that's where it used to be cooking. When I first wrote the book in 97, from 90 to 97, I collected things that were mostly obscure academic endeavors. It's moved into industry. That's an indication of a tipping point. We work with gosh, companies like Boeing and General Mills and Interface and HOK and Herman Miller and Kohler and Nike and you name it. I mean, so increasingly, I think there's a desire to have a biologist at every design table at innovation labs. That will be a metric when there's a biologist at every design table.
Let me ask you a question, which I don't know whether it's – I think it might have been Elizabeth Satoris who mentioned this to me. She said that biology got changed in the 20th century from a field study to basically physics.
Yeah.
Right? As a biologist yourself. Where what really the serious – biology was molecular biology. And in some sense, what this whole biomimicry field is shifting back to the older vision of biology, isn't it?
Yes, you're so, you're astute, Terrence. I like talking to you. It's true. We dove into molecular biology and, you know, to the point where this was one of those metrics. A lot of universities let their field insurance lapse, meaning the biologists were not going out into the field anymore, literally. Everything was in silico. They were like, and everything. I literally talked to friends of mine who were biologists who studied a particular one of our model organisms, which is a mustard plant, a kind of mustard. And I would go in the field with them, you know, on a walk, on a hike, and point at the plant and say, do you know what that is? And it was the model organism they'd been studying for 12 years, but at the molecular level, and they couldn't identify it in the field.
That's pretty amazing.
So what biomimicry does is take us out of that and bring us back to an organismal level and bring us back to an ecological level because we're looking we're not looking at genotypes, we're looking at phenotypes, that is what comes out once the genetic code is transcribed. What comes out are morphologies and behaviors and physiologies that are very beautifully instructive to us.
We're talking to Janine Benyus. She's the author of Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature, and kind of the creator of the whole field, which, if you've been listening to this conversation, is both, to my mind, one of the most hopeful fields, one of the most hopeful things happening in the way that we deal with the world, and just very exciting. You can learn more at biomimicry.net or asknature.org. Let me ask you about something which I think is a huge one and seems different than so many things we're talking about, which is natural systems agriculture.
That's a term of Wes Jackson's at the Land Institute. The premise here is that we're not the first ones to want to grow things, and that it's very similar to EPS in a way, and you're saying, if you're in a locale, you should look at what the land would be producing there, what would be growing if we weren't there, and if you're in the middle of the country, for instance, it would be prairie. So Wes's feeling is that we should mimic the patterns of the prairie in our agriculture, or if you're in tropical areas, you should mimic the patterns of the three-story tropical rainforest in your agriculture. Grow nuts and tree crops and cereals and herbs. But in the prairie area, he's been working at this, 30 years now. And what he's done is he's looked at prairies and said, what do all prairies have in common? Are there any key principles, key design principles? He found four. He said, look, they're all 99% perennial plants, which is completely different than our agriculture, which is 100% annual plants, which you have to dig up the soil every year and replant. He said, you know, they're in mixtures of species, completely opposite to our agriculture,
right,
the monoculture. He said there's four suites of species, warm season grasses, cool season grasses, legumes, and composites. And he said, you know, maybe we should do a mixture of agricultural crops in the field, perennialize those crops so that they overwinter and hold down the soil, and that mixture should include those four suites of species. What the mixture gets you is resistance against pests, because when pests come in, they basically get confused. You know, they might be able to eat one plant, but they're very specific to a kind of plant. So when they go next door, it's a plant that they don't specialize in. Whereas in a monoculture, it's an all-you-can-eat restaurant, and they just keep going. The other thing is, in this mixture, it sponsors its own fertility. Prairies sponsor their own fertility by having legumes, nitrogen fixers, in the mix.
Yeah.
So reduce the amount of fertilizer, reduce the amount of pesticide, both of which are fossil fuel-based, made out of natural gas, reduce the amount of plowing with diesel. So, you know, you begin to have an agriculture that's robust and not dependent on us, as dependent on us. It's got a wild robustness. It's a Google-esque project on his part. He's trying to perennialize the major crops. And then figure out what mixtures to plant them in.
And how is that going? It sounds so, as you pointed out, it does this, which is the direct opposite of what we do. It does.
Yeah.
How is it going so far?
You know, it's actually going really well. I remember a time about 6 or 8 years ago, when there was this huge exodus of really talented plant breeders from academia to West, to the Land Institute. They really felt like, you know, they were tired of working on the big four. They literally, this is a quote from one of them, I'm working on the big four, like wheat and corn and soy. I'm working on these crops, and I'm being told to breed them so that they grow in the presence of larger doses of pesticides and herbicides.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And I'm going backwards. And so he got a very, very professional team of people, and they're doing very well. They've been able to perennialize wheat and a lot of other crops. They have had tremendous results in companion planting them and actually over-yielding, meaning there's more seeds when you put these all together. They're not in direct competition for each other, so they use the habitat better when you have a mixture of species. And, of course, you know, lower pest outbreaks. Right now they're working on getting good taste and other agronomic characteristics into the plants.
Well, that is very exciting. Where could people learn more about that?
That's the Land Institute.
Great, great.
.org.
I mean,
yeah.
Finally, let me, I'm going to have you, in a couple of minutes, just do sort of a speed wrap of some of the most exciting things going on. But one question I did want to ask is, are there ethical questions in imitating nature? And I'm now standing sort of outside this conversation and kind of listening, going, does nuclear power generation mimic nature? Is that biomimicry gone awry? Or is the definition of mimicking nature more subtle or more deep, that you can't just mimic a natural process, you've got to do it in a way that doesn't violate nature, et cetera, et cetera. Could you talk a little about that?
You bet. Yeah, you know, it's looking to nature as model, measure, and mentor. And so you're asking yourself, what would nature do here? And you're also asking yourself, perhaps a more important question, what wouldn't nature do here?
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, nuclear energy is not biotic. It's, you know, you can say, hey, let's mimic a volcano or let's mimic the sun, and that would be abiotic. An organism would blow up, burn to a crisp. So biological, we only look at mimicking biological phenomenon. And then the other thing is that if you mimic something in, so you would say to yourself, what wouldn't nature do here? It's nuclear energy. Because there's also life's lessons, life's principles that say things like you can't have toxins. Life produces toxins like snake venom, but it produces them in small amounts, just in time, and it doesn't store them in large pools over long periods of time. So right away with nuclear energy and the waste issue, you're definitely running up against one of life's principles. So deep biomimicry looks not just at a mechanism, but also at life's principles. So it asks things like, am I optimizing rather than maximizing this invention? What about the scale of this invention? How does it affect other things in its ecosystem? Does it lead towards creating conditions conducive to life or not? And if it doesn't, then to me it's not truly biomimetic yet.
Mm-hmm. One can imitate cancer, but do you want to?
That's it. You look at a larger picture. I mean, there are systems, and you pick and choose. There are systems in the natural world like a type 1 ecosystem, what we call a type 1 ecosystem, ecologists. It's basically a weed field. You know, you dig up a farmer's field, and then weeds come in the first year, annual plants, and sometimes invasive weeds. And, you know, they do their job. They heal that landscape, but they don't stay on the landscape. In a year, they create seeds and blow away to the next opening.
Ah.
And that really is the way we've been doing things.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't make sense in our current Earth environment. It did when we had a huge full world to explore and we were this small species.
Right.
We were colonizers. Now we've come around the Earth and met ourselves. We have a very full Earth, very crowded Earth, and we have to choose another strategy in the natural world, which is that of the forest that remains on the landscape and recycles everything and makes the most of it, because it's not going anywhere for hundreds and hundreds of years. That's so you do pick and choose what you mimic, and you mimic it in context,
right?
In a larger context of principles,
because nature is always in context.
Yeah,
that's what ecosystems and echo niches and all of that is. It's context. So finally,
right.
Janine Benyus, author of Biomimicry and founder of the Biomimicry Institute, with more information at biomimicry.net. 6, 7 minutes. What are the things that are blowing your mind? What are the things that people will, when they get out of the car after hearing the show, go and tell somebody, you can't imagine what's happening?
Well, one thing that I'm kind of interested in, you're talking about biomimetic inventions.
Yeah, yeah.
And companies and things like
yeah.
that. Yeah, there's a really interesting company in California called Calera, C-A-L-E-R-A. And it's a company that takes CO2 emissions out of smokestacks, right out of the Moss Landing power plant, sprays seawater through that, and out precipitates a particular kind of crystalline form of calcium carbonate that can be made into concrete without Portland cement. Now, it is mimicking the same process that coral reefs use.
Uh-huh.
And what's interesting is that coral reefs absorb CO2 to make their cement and their concrete, their reefs. But we, in our normal industrial processes, we emit CO2. So this Calera process actually allows, by following the recipe of the coral reef, we're absorbing CO2 and sequestering it long-term in a building material. And it cuts out having to mine the calcium and carbonate. You wind up with a byproduct, which is you can make fresh water out of it. That's really a nice. I like that system.
That seems...
this idea of using CO2 as a feedstock.
Oh my God, yes! It answers mm-hmm. so many. I mean, in fact, it's our use of CO2 that's killing the coral reefs.
Exactly.
And
it's
now
really
we're going
amazing.
To imitate the coral reef, so that we don't have to use as much CO2.
Exactly.
And we don't give off
exactly.
as much. That's exciting.
And Brent Constance, who is the coral expert who started this company, we've talked with him about giving back a percentage of the proceeds, and we're hoping he will do that once he's at the point of making a profit, giving back a percentage of the proceeds to conserve coral reef habitat.
Sure.
Sort of a thank you for the...
Yeah, the model, the yeah. mentor.
Exactly.
Okay, a few others.
Well, there's a... there's an initiative we're looking at working on right now, which is let me back up and talk about maybe other biomimetic products. So there's I think the next Velcro is going to be something called Lotus Effect, which is a way of having self-cleaning fabrics through structure, the way leaves have these small nano bumps on them, lotus leaves, that force water to ball up and lift dirt particles away. That's you're going to see in, it's already in hundreds of thousands of buildings in Europe. There's a paint that when it dries, it has a bumpy structure and rainwater cleans the building. It's also in fabrics like Green Shield from Big Sky Technologies. It needs no detergent. You clean it literally with water. And so the buildings need no sandblasting. It's, you know, they're cleaned with water.
There's the one of the Galapagos shark repelling bacteria. Yeah. That sounds like something that we need.
Yeah, that's a whole new way of dealing with bacteria without using chemicals that breed resistance, superbugs. Instead, there's you mimicking the skin of the Galapagos shark, a very slow-moving shark that has no bacteria on its surface. The reason is because of its these little ripples, these nano ripples that repel bacteria, basically. And so there's a company called Sharklet that's making thin film that you can put on doorknobs or hospital railings or any surface really in a hospital to repel bacteria without harsh cleansers or chemicals. Another really cool one, and it's there in California also, is a company called Biomatrica. And what they've done is find a way to store biologicals, vaccines, proteins, DNA, without using refrigeration. Right now, enormous amounts of money are spent on keeping things like vaccines cold.
Right, and the places often where we need the vaccines the most are the places where it's the most difficult to keep them cold.
Mm-hmm. That's right. 50% of people who should be getting their vaccines don't because there's a break in the cold chain. So this is learned from brine shrimp. I don't know if you've ever played with brine shrimp as a kid, but those little critters that you put, they were dried up little pellets, and then you add water and they come back to life.
There's something monkeys, they're called, right?
Sea monkeys. And what they do, and other organisms do as well, is this cool thing where they can dry up almost completely and then spring back to life when you add water, and even after like a couple of hundred years, some of these organisms. And what's happening is that they have a certain sugar in their cells that protects their cells, and so they are mimicking this. They're coating their
vaccines,
their biologicals with this, and you can imagine unplugging all the freezers in all the labs and hospitals across the world. How much savings that would be, and how many lives saved actually? So that's a
big
cool
one. Yeah, the examples you chose actually. Bacteria, vaccines, CO2, just happen also to be the biggest problems we're facing.
I know. In the energy space, there's so many cool things going on. But here's a really simple one, and it shows you that sort of anyone can do biomimicry. Anybody who has access to the biological literature. There's a group of students in Cal Poly that have a brilliant idea. They are putting wind turbines. Now, these are not horizontal wind turbines, but vertical ones, vertical axis ones, you know, that look like kind of helical shapes. They're putting them in formation, learning from schooling fish. When fish swim together, as they do their little sinuous moves, they create a vortex along their body. And that vortex spins off, and the fish behind them actually curls their body around that vortex and allows it to sling them upstream. So they actually get a little speed hit, you know, from the fish ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
So what these students did was they said, why don't we put vertical wind turbines in tight formations and allow the vortexes coming off of one to start the other one spinning? And they're actually using less land area than you would with a horizontal wind farm, and they're calculating they'll get 10 times the wind power.
10 times. That's not 10% more. That's 10
no,
times. That
10
is
times,
that is fabulous.
Which is just, I mean, and so they're doing the test now. They've gotten land and they're doing the test. But there's an example where they're not making anything new. They're just putting it together in a new way based on schooling fish, which
excellent.
I just think is brilliant.
Excellent. Janine, I got to close it. So the book, again, is Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature. The websites are biomimicry.net, biomimicry.net, and asknature.org. You can visit me at terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website to learn more about the show, guests, podcasts, transcripts, articles, and so on, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime by linking to the podcast at that site or at iTunes. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about, plus some background on the issues, you can sign up there at my site, or you can email me at T.E. McNally at Mac.com. Thank you to Devin Jordan, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi and Mark Maxwell in production, Matt Perez in traffic, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.